makes it easier.
Okay.
That's it, that's true, you won't know.
I'll be lucky if I can get the unit to work.
Je vais chercher là. Bon, ok.
Donc, on va dire au moins
au Casbah. Ok. D'accord. Parfait.
Oh, okay.
Thank you for coming. Bonjour. Bonjour. Bienvenue à la conférence Dissidence, Parole et Pouvoir. Mon nom est Nathalie Desrosiers. Je suis la directrice exécutive et avocate principale de l'Association canadienne des libertés civiles. Ça me fait grand plaisir de vous accueillir aujourd'hui. This morning's session is both in French and in English. We have presenters who are speaking in both languages, and we are happy to provide the simultaneous translation this morning. So please help yourself to an appareil, one of these apparatus that will allow you to understand our speakers as the move between the two languages. The session this morning, la session s'appelle « Voter avec ses pieds, démocratie, liberté d'assemblée pacifique et désobéissance civile, voting with your feet, democracy and freedom of peaceful assembly ». Je me rends compte qu'il y a beaucoup de monde qui veulent avoir, je vais attendre. Bravo. Alors, je vais continuer un peu dans « This one doesn't work ». OK. Ben, merci beaucoup. Merci. Merci à nos interprètes qui sont là-bas. Donc, juste pour continuer, quelques mots, évidemment, de bienvenue. Tout d'abord, je veux remercier les commanditaires de cet événement, Bombardier, Osler, le Syndicat canadien de la fonction publique qui nous offre la traduction simultanée et le bureau Irvin Mitchell Kalikman. So, merci beaucoup. Je vais commencer sans plus tarder à présenter nos conférenciers. So this morning we'll have three presentations. And then there will be certainly, I think, some period of question after. So our first speaker this morning is Professor Dominique Clément. The full biographies are in the folder. So I'm just going to introduce them briefly, you know, not giving justice, doing justice to their career, but simply to say, Professor Clément is an assistant professor of sociology at University of Alberta and is adjunct professor in the Department of History and Educational Policy Studies. And he has written the book on the history of civil liberties in Canada. It's a great book that we invite you to read, and he has a forthcoming book that is advertised as well on the history of human rights legislation. Our second speaker will be Jamie Cameron, and she is the go-to person in Canada on freedom of expression. She is a scholar at York University, and she's been at Osgoode Hall Law School for many years. She has degrees from McGill and from Columbia University. She was a clerk at the Supreme Court of Canada, and she's been writing extensively and has been really a real scholar in the freedom of expression, freedom of the press area. Et finalement, Jacinthe Poisson est une étudiante en droit, et j'ai rencontré Jacinthe dans le cadre de ce qui s'est passé au G20 à Toronto. Elle va raconter évidemment son expérience. Et je pense que ce qu'il faut souligner, c'est qu'avec beaucoup de courage et beaucoup de réflexion, elle a amené la question de ce qui s'est passé au G20 sur la place publique et l'a fait avec beaucoup d'intelligence. Elle est allée jusqu'à la Cour interaméricaine, a écrit sur le sujet. Nous sommes vraiment enchantés qu'elle soit ici. Merci, Jacinthe. Alors, sans plus tarder, Dominique.
Ah oui? Non, c'est correct. Pas sûr que j'ai besoin de commencer à chanter ou quelque chose comme ça. OK. Alors, bienvenue tout le monde. Je fais mon présentation en anglais aujourd'hui, mais s'il vous plaît, n'hésitez pas de demander des questions en français après. For my presentation today, I'd like to make three points. My first point is that Canada has a long history of social protest and state repression. My second point is that there was a shift in policing beginning in the 1980s, towards more cooperative policing. My third point is that we are in the midst of a shift back to confrontation. Sorry. Yeah, so three points I'd like to make today. First point is that Canada has a long history of social protest and state repression. My second point is that there's been a shift in policing protests that began in the 1980s towards a more cooperative policing system. And my third point is that there's been a shift more recently back to confrontation between movements and authorities. This trend, I suggest, has serious repercussions for our fundamental freedoms in Canada and should be seen as part of a failure to create a better civilian review system for the police. Try to think of social movements as a politics by another means, the inevitable tool for citizens who lack access to political and economic power. Social movements are, in this sense, an essential element of democracy. So in 19th century Canada, movements often took the form of violent reactions to state formation and were met with equally violent responses by the state. The birth of modern Canada arguably began amidst the rebellions of 1837-38, which was met with a swift military response by colonial leaders. The Métis rebellions of 1869 and 1885, which produced one of the first proposed bills of rights in Canada, were directed against a distant Canadian state and were also violently suppressed. By the 20th century, movements in Canada turned increasingly towards peaceful assembly to challenge the state, but the state continued to respond with excessive force. In 1919, when workers in Winnipeg initiated the largest labor strike in Canadian history, governments used the police and military to disperse crowds, at one point killing several citizens. In 1935, in an effort to put a halt to the Ottawa Trek protest of unemployed men in the midst of the Depression, the federal government used the RCMP to disperse the workers. Police fired into the crowd, launched tear gas, and ultimately caused the death of one police officer and one protester. During World War I and World War II, the freedom to associate, assemble, and protest were severely restricted. More than 30 political, social, religious, and ethnic organizations were banned, and movement leaders were interned. In the 1950s, Quebec's Maurice Duplessis became infamous for his attacks on Jehovah's Witnesses. Several municipalities prohibited them from distributing tracts on the streets, but Duplessis charged them with sedition. In 1959, Joey Smallwood in Newfoundland responded to a strike by the International Woodworkers of America by introducing emergency labor laws, often unsighted but actually very serious restriction on civil liberties that's often overlooked in Canadian history. Essentially what the law did was it decertified the IWA, created a new state-created union, empowered the government to dissolve trade unions, prohibited secondary picketing, and made unions liable for illegal acts committed on their behalf. Another state-imposed restriction on peaceful assembly, back-to-work legislation, became more common by the 1970s. There were only three back-to-work laws in the entire 1950s. Three. In the 1960s, there were 13. In the 1970s, there were 31 back-to-work laws. And between 1980 and 1984 alone, there were 22. In 1969, Montreal City Council, concerned about public disorder arising from a strike against the newspaper La Presse, introduced Bylaw 3926, ironically titled Bylaw Relating to the Exceptional Measures to Safeguard the Free Exercise of Civil Liberties. This law allowed the Executive Council to ban any assembly or to disperse a gathering of two or more people, which may sound familiar. In 1970, the federal government imposed the War Measures Act in response to a violent manifestation of the independence movement in Quebec. Only a year later, the Gastown riot in Vancouver demonstrated authorities' continued failure to develop nonviolent methods to address peaceful protest in Canada.
I asked the mayor how he could ignore the dozens, even hundreds, of reports about police behavior.
Police did a most commendable job. Pictures I've seen in the local press, there's a lot of discussion of using riot sticks with one hand. The pictures I saw showed them always in two hands. There were dozens of photographers down there. If there had been any police brutality, those pictures would have been spread across those front pages. They weren't there. because the brutality wasn't there.
Well, there's television film of police whacking people across the head and so on with these riot sticks, which you yourself said you would pay for if council wouldn't bring them in.
Yes, but perhaps that fellow that was getting whacked over the head had just thrown a paving brick at that officer.
And perhaps he hadn't.
Well, I mean, you show your part of the film. The officer certainly must have had a reason for doing it. There were some 53 people charged. You can't tell me that they're all innocent.
What do you say to Alderman Sweeney, who's...
Can't argue with his logic, can you? Okay. In 1994, in what at the time was the largest mass protest in Canadian history, Clayquot Sound momentarily became the focal point of the global environmental movement. Clayquot Sound symbolized a new trend in policing social protests that had begun to emerge in the 1980s. It was, with some notable exceptions, a peaceful protest wherein the police endeavored to avoid confrontation and violence. But British Columbia, always the site of... Hello? No, je continue une autre vidéo après. Yeah. British Columbia, always the site of social protests in Canada, became another controversy in 1997. In this case, attempts to use new technologies and tactics backfired on the police.
A few tried to break through the barriers, and police responded with pepper spray, dogs, and dozens of arrests. Terry Malefsky now on the protesters and their message for the world.
Liberal doses of pepper spray and dozens of noisy arrests threw a sharp light on the debate over APEC and human rights. The scene was the security perimeter at the University of British Columbia, not far from where the leaders were pledging themselves for the economic and social well-being of their people. Student demonstrators challenged police lines, tore down a security fence, and with eyes stung by the spray, insisted that APEC is still ignoring human rights.
Poor people in the countries are supposed to be able to prosper. Well, I hate 65. Don't you think that's ample time? Don't you think that...
APEC summit probably never would have got off the ground 4 years ago unless Canada and the United States on economics. That bargain today, in the view of APEC critics, is an embarrassment.
Put the dogs on the side, you are going that way.
Police were free with the pepper spray again as the leaders' motorcades left the university, and the students were not alone in wondering what the APEC communique really means by... Okay.
The emergence of the anti-globalization movements in the 1990s produced new challenges for authorities. Entire cities, most notably Seattle, of course, in 1999, but certainly not alone, were virtually shut down by alliances of labor, environmentalists, social justice, and a host of other movements. Police tactics such as agents provocateurs became the source of intense controversy and criticism, as was the case during the Montebello summit of 2007.
Come on, it's our line. Fuck her off to your line. This is our line. Get out of here.
I did not move this. 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 I did not move this.
I did not move this. Hey, I got your mouth, brother. Take your mouth.
No.
Put the rock down, man. Put the rock down.
Hey.
Put the rock down. This is all mine. No fucking rock. No fucking rock. Get out of town.
I think at that point, the police officers just didn't know what to do. And then, of course, finally, more confrontational police tactics emerged more recently with, of course, as many of you are familiar, the recent G20 protests. In
man. That's stupid. They fucking threw that old man on the ground. What do you mean, okay? Did you see that poor old man? They punched him in the face.
They can't carry you home. They're wearing
makeup. Holy shit! Fuck!
Finally, of course, the recent student protests and the Occupy movement demonstrate that despite innovations in policing, police are still using excessive force and governments are imposing draconian policies to restrict the right to assemble. Quebec's Bill 78 is probably one of the most draconian pieces of legislation Canada's ever seen. My second point is that beginning in the 1980s, there was a shift towards cooperative policing. As protests became a regularized and common feature of social and political life, police forces developed extremely detailed plans. Protesters negotiated with police in advance to ensure predictable outcomes, even if this meant token violations of the law. Activists could ensure that the event would take place, everyone would get home safely. Police could plan reasonable expectations for staffing and officers. If there was civil disobedience, there was a space for stretchers and buses to transport protesters without hurting them. Also, authorities could make space arrangements for arraignments in court. This is what's called the police management, public order management system. I won't go into detail, I'll skip over this a bit quickly, but essentially these are the five key points that define the new cooperative policing regime. This idea that authorities now have a greater concern with constitutional rights to make sure that they protect the rights of the protesters. Police have more tolerance for community disruption. There's more communication between the police and demonstrators. No longer using arrests against mass demonstrations or using controlled arrests rather than mass ones. And trying to reduce the use of force and arrests as a means to control protesters. Certainly, if you look at the Gastown riot and the On to Ottawa trek, and you look at more recent developments, there is something of a shift compared to the way the police used to address protesters. There's also a relationship between changing police tactics and changing social movement tactics as well. Since the 1970s, there's been a proliferation of social movement organizations. These are more organized, hierarchically organized groups with staff, offices, boards of directors. These type of groups tend to be engaged in less confrontational tactics. They tend to use more mainstream tactics, lobbying, campaigning, for instance, rather than marches, demonstrations. So there is a bit of a correlation between changing police tactics and changing tactics by protesters as well. Arguably, protest has also become more of a mainstream political tool in Canada and the United States. For instance, one of the things you notice between like the Gastown riot and Clayquot Sound is the presence of more white, middle-class, urban people participating in protests, which is a big switch from the 50s and the 1960s. So there is this cooperative policing system. My final point, though, and let's go through this quickly to finish up, is that there is a trend, I'd argue, back towards police militancy. This was clearly evident in the 1990s during the APEC summit in Montebello, and more recently with the G20 protests. Police militancy takes the form of agents provocateurs, riot squads, kettling, sound cannons, mass arrests, intelligence gathering, infiltrating activist groups, preventative police tactics, increasing use of tasers, tear gas, pepper spray, and rubber bullets, barricades, techniques like that. Police training encourages officers to caricature quote-unquote anarchists as youth wearing certain clothes and to respond with greater force when these individuals are participating in a protest. As Hall and DeLint have shown, many police in Canada believe that extraordinary force is essential in circumstances when public order is threatened. This focus on protecting public order invariably leads to tactics that severely restrict the right to assemble. Still, as Leslie Wood has demonstrated, police forces in Canada have not wholeheartedly shifted to militant tactics. Mass protests in Canada are marked, most protests in Canada are marked by no arrests, and only a very small number involve the use of coercive tactics. It remains to be seen, however, if this trend will continue or if police militancy will increase. Police often respond with violence when protesters refuse to negotiate or cooperate. Essentially, the police assume that these activists will engage in public disorder and plan accordingly. It's also been well shown, I think, that police are likely to arrest protesters when there's evidence of pre-mobilization and planning. Finally, and I can go into more detail during the question period, I also think it's worth noting that few, if any, Canadian jurisdictions have yet to develop what I would argue is an effective civilian review system for the police. When I was on the board of the BC Civil Liberties Association, I had several meetings with the Office of the Police Complaints Commissioner. This office has been credited as being the most effective civilian review system in Canada, although arguably the recent independent review system in Ontario might create a similar effective model. And yet, despite having presided over numerous police abuses, including the riot at the Hyatt and other violent attacks on protesters, discipline against police officers was minimal. And even the current Ontario system, police discipline remains minimal. And most officers might receive a few days without pay or a brief demotion that lasts a month or perhaps a few months. Civilian review systems across Canada are plagued by delays, overdependence on police investigators, lack of independence, police indifference, limited resources, and a lack of political will to create accountability. Creating better accountability systems would, I suggest, be the most effective response to police militancy and the best way to protect freedom of peaceful assembly. Thank you very much.
Bonjour et merci. Good morning, and I'd like to begin by thanking Natalie Desrosiers and the CCLA for inviting me to participate in the Rights Watch conference this year, and I'd also like to thank my colleague Colleen Shepherd and the Legal Center for the Center for Human Rights and Legal Pluralism for hosting us here. I am a McGill alum, and it's nice to be back here and at the law school. So I'm going to try and make my remarks fairly quickly, as Dominique did, and leave time for questions. We're a little bit behind in this panel. And as you'll appreciate, the panel's mandate is really quite grand, and we have the Quebec student protest and Bill 78 on our minds. But what I'm going to do is speak about public expression generally, and by that I mean everything from an assembly of one up to mass protest and mass demonstrations. And I think the organizers had in mind that I would speak about the law and perhaps even the Supreme Court of Canada jurisprudence. But I think what I'm going to do instead is I'm going to pick out two issues that are of particular concern to me and take a few minutes to explain why I'm concerned about these two particular issues. And these are areas of risk for the Charter's fundamental freedoms. By the Charter's fundamental freedoms, of course, I mean Section 2B, freedom of expression, Section 2C, freedom of peaceful assembly, and Section 2D, freedom of association. And the two areas of risk I have identified are, number one, content. And by that, I mean, by that, what I want to talk about is the vulnerability of unpopular, offensive, undemocratic messages, the vulnerability of those who carry those messages to being stopped, censored, arrested, and punished. That's an area of very great concern for me. And the second area I want to touch on briefly, and I guess to the extent time permits, is access to public space. And there the issue I want to point to in particular is the no-go zones, the bubble zones, the areas that have been picked out either by court order or by legislation as areas where Section 2 fundamental freedoms activity is absolutely prohibited. I have real concerns about those kinds of no-go zones. So first, just a preliminary point, and it's sort of trite, but I have to say it anyway, and that is that public expression, of course, is at the very core of the Charter's fundamental freedoms. Public expression is centrally connected to the Charter's democratic aspirations, and it's invaluable as a catalyst for change. It's invaluable as a test of authority. It's invaluable as a vehicle for accountability of public officers, and it's a forum as well for exposing injustice. We just couldn't overstate the importance of public expression to the Charter's fundamental freedoms. And I think the mass protests just within the last year and in recent memory have been extremely effective, despite the problems with policing and police accountability. And here, of course, I refer to the Occupy movements and to the Quebec student demonstrations. And taking to the streets is a right, of course, and an entitlement under the Charter. But in a certain sense, it can even be thought of as a civic responsibility or a civic duty. And here I just want to borrow the words of Abraham Lincoln, which I think it's a really nice thought, where he once remarked, "To sin by silence when they should protest makes cowards of men." So there is that importance of public expression. And I guess the last thing I'd say before turning to my two points is that I found Dominique's footage really, really compelling, because you can forget over time and the particular incidents, you can forget how compelling mass demonstrations and protests can be. And I guess what I wanted to say about that is that, you know, when there is a democratic groundswell, an uprising, I think that a mass protest really puts law's authority at a low ebb. And I think we did see that in the Occupy movements and with the Quebec student demonstration. And not at all to discount the problems with policing and police accountability. Nonetheless, I think one of the positive messages of the last year is that this kind of public expression can be extremely effective. And should so it's a matter of great seriousness to all of us to think through how best to protect it and to ensure its efficacy as an instrument for democratic evolution. Okay, now let me turn to my two key concerns. And the first one is about protecting content in public expression. And as I said before, my concern here is that certain messages and certain speakers will be singled out and targeted by the police because the message is considered offensive, because it's considered unpopular, because it's considered unacceptable. And the speaker and the speaker's message are marginalized, and they can be easily picked out by the police, arrested, detained, punished, and so forth. And I'm going to give you three quick examples which go from the instance of an assembly of one all the way up to the sort of the mass protest example. I'm thinking actually of Terry Jones, but that's not really the same thing. But he, as you know, he was stopped at the border just a couple of days ago. You know, it really wasn't because he erroneously referred to himself as a doctor and the Germans were after him for a fine. It was all about the content of his message. Anyway, back to the issue of peaceful assembly. My example of the assembly of one is a guy called Eric Brazeau, who last year, I don't know if Natalie knows who I'm speaking about, maybe others of you do. Eric Brazeau was a guy who in Toronto last year, I think it was 2011, there was a funeral procession for a police officer who had died in the line of service. Eric Brazeau attended the funeral procession down the streets of Toronto, and he held up a sign. And his sign said, I have to read it to get it right. The sign said, "Soldiers die, electricians die, and people die." That was one side of the sign. And the other sign said, "No police state." The guy was arrested and detained. And he wasn't charged. I don't think they actually went through with charges. But he was detained under the catch-all for creating or causing a public disturbance, Section 175 of the Criminal Code. So, you know, there's an example of a person who's singled out, targeted by the police, and detained simply because the message, which I don't know about you, but I don't find it really all that offensive, but because the message was perceived as being offensive. Now, that's, to my mind, a legitimate instance of public expression. Second, and I better speed up, the second one is the example of an assembly of a few. And this is one of my favorites, and Natalie will appreciate this as well. These are two Saskatchewan individuals, a husband and wife, John and Johanna Lucas, who in 1993 led a demonstration in placard demonstration in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, to protest a serious miscarriage of justice and gross negligence by a police officer. And I won't read out to you what their placards said. They were very offensive, no question. They insinuated that the police officer was involved in some criminal activity himself. But the point of my example is that, and they were not the only two, there were a few others who were there with them at the time of the demonstration, but of course their placards drew them very, very, very quickly to the attention of the police. They were expeditiously arrested, detained, charged, and convicted of defamatory libel, which is an offense under the criminal code, and they served jail sentences for carrying the placards, which called into question, undoubtedly in an offensive way, called into question the reputation of the police officer. Okay, so then the third example I have is the Assembly of Many, and I'll just be very brief here. I wanted to say a word about APEC and the pepper spray incident of 1997. We've already seen a clip, and my point is actually a different one than the one about excessive force. My point is that, you know, at this, we focus on the excessive force, but there was a real element there, and it was all about silencing those who had critical messages to make, critical messages to deliver about some of the regimes that were visiting as part of they were guests of Canada at this summit. And so it was about silencing those individuals who wanted to complain about the practices of some of those regimes. And you might not remember, but individuals at the APEC summit were arrested for their signage. So this is not about, you know, pushing or breaking the security fence or anything like that. That's just about the signs, just about the content of the message. And indeed, I believe I'm right in saying that the Tibetan flag was displayed somewhere in the course of all the APEC incidents and was taken down because that, again, was highly, highly offensive to visitors of Canada during the APEC summit. So, you know, really what you see there is an attempt to shut down any critical content. Again, it goes back to my point about the need to protect content in public spaces. So I'm watching the time. I do want to provide a couple of examples just to highlight the difference in the United States and to show you what it looks like under a system of constitutional rights that is serious about content neutrality and is serious and has a serious anti-censorship, anti-discrimination principle that is built into protections for freedom of speech and association. Because in the United States, generally speaking, of course there are exceptions, but in the United States, generally speaking, the state does not have the authority to single out messages for their content and to either censor those messages or punish those messages. Two very quick examples. There's the classic example, which is Skokie 1978, and this case did not reach the U.S. Supreme Court, but this is a very famous example of the American Nazi Party, which planned a peaceful demonstration in the village of Skokie. Well, you need to know something about the village of Skokie, which was that the village of Skokie, the residents of Skokie were predominantly Jewish people, and many of them were Holocaust survivors or relatives of Holocaust survivors. And despite that setting and that context, the courts of Illinois upheld the right of the American Nazi Party to conduct a completely and purely peaceful demonstration. That has to be seen as a high water mark for content neutrality because it's agreed by all that the content of that demonstration was especially offensive. Second example is a more recent one, and I'm using it as a sort of a contrast to Eric Brazeau. This is a case from about a year or maybe 2 years ago in the U.S. Supreme Court. It's called Snyder versus Phelps. And you might have read about it because it was picked up in the Canadian press. This is the case where the Westboro Baptist Church conducted a nasty demonstration. I think I could, I wouldn't be unfair to say that it was a nasty demonstration against the U.S. and the U.S. military near the site of a church where a fallen serviceman's funeral was being held. Highly, highly offensive to the family. Alarmingly offensive, but peaceful nonetheless. And the Westboro Baptist Church knew full well that they needed to comply with police requirements. They knew that because I read just a couple of days ago, I didn't know this before, that they have conducted more than 600 protests at funerals over a period of 20 years. And for whatever reason, this was the one that made its way to the U.S. Supreme Court. Okay, so my point is that these are high water marks for content neutrality under the First Amendment. And we might have our own views about whether content neutrality is out of hand in the United States under the First Amendment. But at the same time, we need to have concerns. Okay, thanks. We need to have serious concerns, I think, about the way content, the content of messages, is or is not protected in Canada when we're talking about public expression. And I guess I'll close off this point and move on to my second point really, really quickly, just by saying, to get you going, because you may well disagree with me, I would just leave it as a proposition that content alone is not grounds for arresting an individual in public space or silencing that person. Now, I have to bracket it and say, except where that person is committing a criminal code offense that is itself not unconstitutional. So I'm taking defamatory libel out of it, and maybe some other things. Okay, very, very quickly on access and public expression. You know, there are limits to the use of public spaces for expressive purposes. There is some right of access to public space under the Charter, but how much there is that will be protected by the courts remains quite unclear. And so I'm really not going to speak too much about this, but I'm going to flag the issue because it's there in Bill 78, which I think you've all noticed, and this is the issue of no-go zones and zones where public expression is prohibited despite or indeed precisely because it's highly effective. And these no-go zones, although they can be content neutral, they're aimed at particular points of view. They are totally aimed at particular points of view. And that's, to my mind, what makes them especially suspicious it's especially suspicious, and we need to look very carefully about the permissibility of this kind of mechanism. So I'm just going to give you three very quick examples and leave you with two questions. So the first example, of course, is the one that's on your mind. That's Section 14 of Bill 78, which protects access to educational institutions and prohibits activities which could deny access to the educational institution, and takes the prohibition, I think, another 50 meters beyond the borders of the property. So that's the example that's on our minds today. But let's think back also to, and Colleen and others might remember this, this is the Supreme Court of Canada decision in BCGEU, 1988, where the court upheld an absolute prohibition on picketing around a courthouse. And the picketing hadn't even begun. They didn't know whether the picketing would impair access. It was an absolute anticipatory prohibition on picketing around a courthouse. And then the third one, and this is again just to provoke you, and this is the example of bubble zones around abortion clinics, which prohibit all expressive activity within the zone. And these bubble zones are both legislative in nature in British Columbia and court-ordered in the province of Ontario. So I'm going to leave you with two thoughts or questions about these bubble zones. The first is to challenge the idea of a bubble zone and to ask whether an absolute prohibition on expressive activity can ever be justified in an entire zone, because there's no attempt to regulate. It's an absolute prohibition. That's the whole idea of a bubble zone. And then the second thing is just to alert you to the possibility that there may be double standards in this area, and that that, you know, if you look at, and I'm not a labor lawyer, but if you look at labor regulations, there it seems to me there's a lot more latitude that is allowed for labor activities and picketing that can impair access to workplaces and so on. But that then has to be juxtaposed with these other issues in other places where bubble zones have started to be used to shut down expressive activity in particular areas, and to do so because it is effective. Okay, conclusion. I guess my message is that despite the effectiveness of recent mass demonstrations and mass protests, we can't be complacent. And in addition to serious issues about police accountability and policing, we need to look at the problem of censorship in public spaces and have healthy skepticism about restrictions on absolute restrictions on expressive activity in no-go zones. Thank you for listening.
Alors, bonjour tout le monde. Un petit instant, je vous installe un PowerPoint. Alors, bonjour tout le monde. Je suis très honorée d'être ici aujourd'hui. Je tiens à remercier l'Association canadienne des libertés civiles et le Centre pour les droits humains et le pluralisme juridique de McGill d'avoir organisé cette conférence-là. Ça va être très intéressant. Je vais parler un petit peu plus fort. Alors, aujourd'hui, on m'a invitée pour vous parler de mon expérience lors du sommet du G20 à Toronto. Je fais partie des 1140 personnes qui ont été arrêtées lors du sommet et de la centaine de Québécois qui ont été arrêtés dans le gymnase de l'Université de Toronto et qui ont été accusés de conspiration pendant 4 mois. Donc, j'ai des collègues ici en droit qui vont probablement être surpris de mon histoire. Alors, ma présentation va être partagée en 2 parties. D'abord, je tiens à vous livrer un témoignage sur ce qui s'est passé concrètement, sur l'arrestation, les conditions de détention et nos accusations subséquentes. Et ensuite, je vais vous parler des recours qui ont été entamés par les victimes et de là vont découler mes réflexions personnelles. Donc, je vais commencer par le contexte. En 2010, le gouvernement conservateur a étonnamment décidé d'organiser son premier sommet du G20 dans la plus grande ville du Canada, en plein centre-ville de Toronto. Il y a eu un périmètre de sécurité qui a été érigé autour du centre des congrès, donc des barrières de métal immenses, comme vous avez pu voir un petit peu plus tôt. Et il y a eu plus de 10 000 policiers qui ont été appelés pour surveiller les manifestations du samedi 26 juin. Alors, il y a eu plus de 30 000 personnes qui sont venues manifester pendant la People's First March, la manifestation principale. Faites le calcul rapidement, on parle d'un policier pour 3 manifestants. De mon côté, j'étais descendue à Toronto avec des centaines de Québécois dans des autobus collectifs. La manifestation du samedi s'est très bien passée de mon côté, c'est joyeux, pacifique. Mais ensuite, je suis allée souper dans un restaurant chinois et à ma sortie, j'ai pu constater les dégâts, des vitres brisées, des autos de police incendiées. Donc, j'ai appris après coup qu'il y a des groupes qui se sont détachés de la manifestation principale et c'est à ce moment-là que c'est arrivé. Mais détrompez-vous, les 1140 arrestations ne sont pas arrivées à ce moment-là. La police est restée loin pendant qu'il y a eu de la casse et n'est pas intervenue. Tant qu'à moi, je ne l'ai pas vue. Le samedi soir, on était plus d'une centaine de Québécois à pouvoir dormir dans l'université, dans le gymnase de l'Université de Toronto, parce que l'association étudiante nous avait prêté le gymnase parce qu'on venait de loin. Le lendemain matin, dimanche, donc le lendemain des manifestations à 9h, tout le monde dormait dans le gymnase de Toronto et des dizaines de policiers sont venus encercler le gymnase, sont entrés dans le gymnase armés de teasers et de fusils, probablement balles de caoutchouc. Ils nous ont crié « Don't move or we shoot ». Alors tout le monde s'est réveillé en pyjama, comprenait pas ce qui se passait. On nous a informé qu'on était en état d'arrestation pour participation à une émeute. Donc, on ne nous a pas présenté de mandat, pas d'explication. Est-ce que c'était l'émeute de la veille? Est-ce qu'on était en émeute à ce moment-là? Je ne suis pas certaine. Le policier, moi, qui m'a arrêté après 5 heures d'attente, m'a expliqué que, selon lui, j'allais être libérée quelques heures plus tard. La police est arrivée, ils ont trouvé du matériel anti-G20 subversif dans le sous-sol, et selon lui, j'étais au mauvais endroit au mauvais moment. Donc, j'allais être libérée. Moi, je me questionne vraiment. Est-ce qu'il y avait vraiment des motifs raisonnables que j'avais, moi, personnellement, commis un crime ou participé à une émeute? Alors, minute aux mains, on nous a amenés dans un studio de cinéma où des... Ah, vous voyez ici l'image de l'arrestation. La qualité n'est pas très bonne, mais ça vous donne une petite idée. Alors, minute aux mains, on nous a amenés dans un studio de cinéma où des cages de métal avaient été construites d'environ 8 mètres par 6 mètres. Vous allez voir des photos un petit peu plus tard. Pendant les détentions, qui ont duré plus de 60 heures, on était parfois jusqu'à 20 personnes dans une cage. Alors, pendant les premières 40 heures de détention, on était dans ce centre temporaire-là. Et à ce moment-là, on avait droit à environ un verre d'eau, un sandwich au fromage et margarine, environ chaque 8 heures. Les néons au plafond étaient allumés 24 heures sur 24. On était très peu habillés, évidemment, quand on était arrêtés, on était en pyjama. Donc, on essayait tous de dormir les uns collés sur les autres, sur le sol de béton froid. Et vous allez pouvoir le voir dans les photos également, on avait une toilette chimique sans porte. C'est-à-dire que les policiers, hommes et femmes, qui passaient dans les couloirs, pouvaient nous voir en tout temps. Nos mains étaient attachées avec des tie wraps pendant environ les 20 premières heures de la détention et ensuite pendant chaque transfert. Une femme qui était avec moi souffrait de dépression, réclamait ses médicaments toute la journée. Les policiers l'ont ignorée jusqu'à ce que finalement elle fasse une crise assez sévère. Finalement, on lui a donné ses médicaments. De mon côté, on m'avait enlevé mes lunettes dès le début de l'arrestation. Puis j'ai eu beau les réclamer toute la détention, on ne les a jamais redonnés. Je suis fortement myope, alors pour ceux qui sont myopes, vous pourrez me comprendre, c'était très déstabilisant pendant 3 jours de rien voir de ce qui se passait autour de moi. Ce qui est surprenant, c'est qu'à plusieurs reprises, des policiers m'ont dit clairement que c'était la loi martiale, que nos droits n'existaient plus. Jamais on n'a eu un mot d'explication sur ce qui se passait, sur ce qui nous attendait, sur nos accusations. Certains policiers nous ont même traités de « fucking Frenchie », pardonnez-moi l'expression, de chiens, ou d'autres policières se sont amusées à me dire qu'ils étaient mes babysitters. Alors, après une quinzaine d'heures, j'ai eu droit à un appel. J'ai finalement pu laisser un message sur la boîte vocale de l'aide juridique. Je dois avouer que tout ça aurait pu être supportable si ça n'aurait pas été les deux fouilles à nu. La première a eu lieu dans le centre de détention même, après environ 20 heures de détention. Tout le monde y a eu droit systématiquement. Ce n'était pas une analyse personnalisée, là. La deuxième a eu lieu dans la prison provinciale où on a été transféré pendant quelques heures. À cet endroit-là, il n'y avait pas de porte qui donnait sur le couloir, c'est-à-dire qu'il y avait un employé masculin qui passait par là qui pouvait nous voir. Quand j'y repense aujourd'hui, je dois avouer que ça me donne encore des frissons. Je pense que c'était la pire partie de la détention. Puis selon moi, c'est probablement la pire façon qu'on peut priver quelqu'un de sa liberté et du contrôle sur son propre corps. C'est vraiment humiliant. Finalement, on a pu comparaître devant un juge après environ 60 heures de détention. Puis là, j'ai appris que j'étais plutôt accusée de conspiration pour commettre un crime contraire au code criminel plutôt que participation à une émeute. Donc, allez comprendre c'était quoi ce crime-là, je ne suis pas certaine. On ne m'a pas laissé lire mes conditions de détention quand on m'a laissé sortir, sinon, comme le policier me disait, j'allais devoir retourner en prison. Le policier qui m'a escorté à la sortie de la cour m'a même dit « You should have stayed in Quebec to commit your crimes ». C'est assez fort. Puis, à la sortie, en plus, on m'a annoncé que tous mes effets personnels avaient été perdus. Donc, j'ai été libérée en banlieue de Toronto, en habit vert de prisonnière, sans mes clés, sans mes lunettes, sans mon argent, sans mon portefeuille, sans rien. Heureusement, mon père était descendu dans la nuit pour venir nous chercher de Montréal. Finalement, mes affaires ont été retrouvées des mois plus tard, puis c'est moi qui ai dû m'arranger pour les faire venir à Montréal, évidemment. Les cellulaires, les appareils photo, tous les vêtements noirs ont été confisqués, incluant les sous-vêtements noirs de ma sœur. C'est très subversif. Alors, cette accusation-là, ça a été maintenue pendant plus de 4 mois. Évidemment, je savais qu'elle était injustifiée, qu'elle allait tomber un jour, mais c'est extrêmement stressant de vivre avec une accusation criminelle aussi grave, surtout quand on veut devenir avocate. Puis, de retour à Montréal, ça nous a pris plusieurs semaines pour s'en remettre émotionnellement. Mais on a décidé quand même de s'organiser. On était loin de Toronto, on était loin des 1000 autres arrêtés, donc on était environ une centaine de Québécois arrêtés. On a formé un regroupement, on a partagé nos expériences, on s'est offert du soutien. On a aussi dénoncé la situation dans les médias, puis on a organisé des recours judiciaires. Alors ici, je tiens à vous partager les recours qui ont été entamés par les arrêtés et par la société civile, puis de là vont découler mes réflexions personnelles. Alors d'abord, en octobre 2010, le Comité permanent de la sécurité publique et nationale de la Chambre des communes a tenu des audiences sur le G20. Étonnamment, il y a eu peu d'arrêtés qui ont été invités, mais j'ai eu la chance de pouvoir le faire. Alors, après mon témoignage, un député conservateur de l'Alberta, je vais oser le nommer Brent Radburger, m'a demandé « Madame, êtes-vous allée manifester pour renverser le gouvernement ou pour renverser le capitalisme ou pour voir Obama? » Ensuite, il m'a demandé « Pensez-vous vraiment que les chefs d'État du G20 allaient être tellement touchés par vos manifestations qu'ils changeraient leur politique? » C'était très choquant, mais c'est encore plus choquant quand on se dit que ce député siège également sur le Comité des droits de l'homme et de la justice. Je vous laisse y penser. Finalement, heureusement, le rapport du comité a déploré les arrestations massives et a même qualifié notre arrestation du gymnase d'arbitraire. Les conservateurs, qui étaient minoritaires à l'époque, sont évidemment en dissidence du rapport. Ensuite, sur les 1140 personnes qui ont été arrêtées pendant le G20, il y en a plus de 300 qui ont déposé des plaintes à l'Office of the Independent Police Review Director, l'OIPRD. Contrairement au Québec, l'Ontario a un organe indépendant composé de civils qui peut faire des enquêtes suite à des plaintes du public. On va pouvoir justement en parler un petit peu plus tard dans un panel aujourd'hui. Dans son rapport qui a été publié en mai 2012, soit près de 2 ans après le G20, l'OIPRD a conclu que le sommet a occasionné la pire vague d'arrestations massives de l'histoire canadienne. C'est-à-dire que comparé par exemple à la crise d'octobre 70, il y a eu 460 arrestations, on est à 1140. Suite à ce rapport-là, le chef de police de Toronto, Bill Blair, a encore refusé de s'excuser. Mais, par exemple, suite à ce rapport, il y a eu des accusations disciplinaires qui ont été lancées contre plusieurs dizaines d'officiers, notamment contre l'officier qui a ordonné l'arrestation du gymnase de l'Université de Toronto, le sergent Meissner. Les audiences vont débuter bientôt. Malheureusement, les seules sanctions qui peuvent découler de ces accusations sont disciplinaires, c'est-à-dire que les officiers pourraient seulement être suspendus quelques jours ou, au pire, être congédiés. Vous comprenez que c'est assez décevant parce que les victimes elles-mêmes ne peuvent pas recevoir aucun dommage pour les préjudices qu'ils ont subis. Heureusement, il y a eu un recours collectif qui a été lancé et qui réclame 75 millions en dommages pour les plus de 1000 personnes arrêtées. Ils veulent également démontrer que les actions policières ont violé la Charte des droits et libertés, incluant les garanties judiciaires, liberté d'expression et de réunion pacifique. J'ai la chance de parler au nom des arrêtés du gymnase dans ce processus-là. Le contre-interrogatoire a eu lieu il n'y a pas très longtemps et on est en étape de certification, c'est-à-dire simplement de faire accepter le recours collectif en Ontario. Donc, on voit que les voies judiciaires qui s'ouvrent devant nous, on a d'un côté ce recours collectif et de l'autre, quelques poursuites disciplinaires. Le premier, le recours collectif, pourrait prendre de 6 à 10 ans, dépendamment des appels. Et le deuxième, on voit que les résultats sont assez limités à des sanctions disciplinaires. Je dois dire que pour les arrêter, c'est vraiment une grande désillusion. On ne reçoit ni excuse du côté politique et du côté juridique, on ne voit pas de possibilité à court terme de faire reconnaître que nos droits ont été violés. Aussi, en tant qu'étudiante en droit, c'est un peu un retour à la réalité. On apprend dans nos cours ce qu'est la protection constitutionnelle des libertés, le contenu de ces libertés-là, mais on se rend compte que vraiment pour les victimes, c'est très difficile d'accéder à ces recours-là et de vraiment sentir qu'on trouve justice. Bon, je vous ramène un peu aux chiffres, aux faits. Des 1140 personnes qui ont été arrêtées, il y en a plus de 800 qui ont été arrêtées, détenues, sans aucune accusation. Il y a plus de 200 accusations qui sont tombées après quelques mois, incluant ceux du gymnase. C'est-à-dire qu'à peine quelques mois après le G20, seulement 8% des personnes avaient encore des accusations. On peut donc vraiment se questionner, est-ce que les arrestations du G20 servaient vraiment à arrêter des individus qui ont commis des actes criminels? Pour moi, il est clair que non. Le chef de la police de Toronto, Bill Blair, l'a lui-même avoué. Il était plus facile de faire des arrestations massives après les actes criminels que d'arrêter ceux qui en commettaient dans la foule pendant les manifestations. Le rapport de l'OIPRD a même révélé que le mot d'ordre dans la police était « take back the streets », comme si les rues appartenaient à la police. Moi, ça me sidère. Tant qu'à moi, l'objectif, c'était clairement d'arrêter les manifestations et de décourager les gens d'y participer. Alors, ces pratiques de criminalisation de la protestation sociale créent ce qu'on appelle en droit national et en droit international le « chilling effect ». Les sanctions légales, dont la menace de sanctions criminelles, ça les fait décourager et dissuader les gens d'exercer leur liberté et d'aller manifester dans la rue. La plupart des gens arrêtés l'ont vécu, cette peur-là. Ils ne sont pas retournés manifester dans les semaines suivantes. Moi-même, aujourd'hui, j'ai encore peur quand je vois la police m'insécurise dans les manifestations, au lieu de me sécuriser. Au-delà des actions policières, je veux aussi que vous soyez très vigilants par rapport aux discours politiques qui les légitimisent, autant pendant le conflit étudiant que pendant le G20, il y avait un discours politique extrêmement inquiétant. Ce discours-là a vraiment l'effet, comme l'a dit ma collègue, de marginaliser les groupes dissidents qui expriment leur message pendant les manifestations. C'est important pour moi, je ne veux pas que vous pensiez que le G20 était un dérapage unique. Le phénomène se répète aujourd'hui. Pendant le conflit étudiant, il y a eu plus de 3380 arrestations. La plupart ont eu droit à des simples contraventions municipales, c'est-à-dire des amendes. Entre autres, il y a eu plus de 500 personnes qui ont été arrêtées dans une arrestation massive le 24 mai, quelques jours après la loi 78, et qui ont simplement eu des constats d'infraction. Pourtant, les médias qui étaient sur place disaient que la manifestation était tout à fait pacifique. Je vous invite aussi à écarter vos allégeances politiques. Donc, on pourrait avoir un long débat pour politique. Est-ce qu'on est pour, contre le G20, pour, contre l'augmentation des frais de scolarité? Ce que je veux vous amener à réfléchir, c'est vraiment le rôle et l'importance du droit de manifester dans notre système démocratique actuel. La manifestation, quant à moi, permet à toutes les idées, tous les discours, qu'ils soient aussi offensants, choquants ou contraires aux idées du gouvernement, de pouvoir s'exprimer. Ça nous permet de confronter des opinions qui sont très différentes, comme on l'a vu dans le conflit étudiant, puis ensuite choisir collectivement les orientations de notre société. C'est aussi une façon pour les groupes qui n'ont pas accès normalement aux canaux institutionnels de se faire entendre. Par exemple, pendant le conflit étudiant, une bonne partie de la jeunesse québécoise est descendue dans la rue. Ils sont sous-représentés dans les partis politiques. C'est vraiment une façon de se faire entendre. Pendant le G20, les manifestations ont permis aussi à une grande diversité de groupes normalement marginalisés de se faire entendre. Je me souviens avoir vu autant des groupes pour la libération du Tibet qu'Amnesty International et Greenpeace. Donc vraiment, c'est une diversité qu'il faut protéger. Donc pour conclure, pour moi, restreindre, prévenir les mouvements de contestation sociale, c'est vraiment très dangereux. Non seulement pour les individus qui sont arrêtés et marginalisés en raison des arrestations et de la répression, mais aussi pour notre société carrément. Parce que si l'espace pour s'exprimer publiquement devient contrôlé, le débat politique est réduit, notre capacité de réflexion personnelle à long terme est sensiblement limitée. Donc, je vous invite peut-être à garder ces réflexions-là en tête au cours des panels qui s'annoncent aujourd'hui, qui vont être très passionnants, j'en suis sûre. Et je vous invite aussi à rester vigilants. Prenez pas pour acquis nos libertés et nos droits au Canada, parce que, comme je l'ai appris, ce n'est pas une réalité qui est tout à fait sécure.
There. I was also at the G20 summit, and I did not get arrested. And one thing that I've noticed in a lot of protests is that the message, in some ways, we end up focusing a huge amount on the behavior of the police, which I think is absolutely fundamental. We need to focus on that. But we lose the message, the original message of the protest. I mean, I was there with Amnesty International, and there were tens of thousands of peaceful protests, and the next day you didn't see a thing about it in the news. And how do we balance that? How do we acknowledge the rights violations and draw attention to them, and yet not not lose the original message of the protest, whatever it happens to be? And I just wanted to know, either perhaps Monsieur Clément or Madame Poisson, if you have any advice for those of us who try to reach this balance.
Ça fonctionne ou ça va? C'est bon. it seems to me that using the traditional media is going to be, for example, after the G20 and with Occupy, I often get calls from the media asking me about social protest, and it's always about the police repression. And as often as I try to get it to thinking about the issues, they don't really seem to have an interest in that. And it kind of makes sense. This is one of the things that I teach when teach my students about social movements. I have a course on social movements at the University of Alberta, is that the restricted limits of using the traditional media for getting your message across. Because the media is a business. The media is designed to do something entertaining. And there's entire studies about the challenges of using the traditional media. So it seems to me that's the best way to get your message across, is trying to to focus on sources through the internet, perhaps even certain, there's some emerging left radio stations, things like that, that might be useful. So that's my initial thought, is maybe using the traditional media is not the, would be your main obstacle avoid doing so. But that's, it's an excellent point that you raise, and this historically has always been the problem, right? Because people do tend to focus on the police abuse, and actually maybe those of us who are asked to comment on the issues, that's another way to deal with it, is perhaps we're not as good as bringing it back to the original message.
I would just add that I'm not so sure the message is always lost. I mean, I think the message was sent with APEC. I think the message was sent last spring, and even with G20. So I wouldn't be overly pessimistic about that, but you raise a really good point. And I guess the only other thing I'd add is that the social media is really a great resource for getting messages out that can't break through into the traditional media.
Oui, c'est une réflexion intéressante parce que pour mon expérience avec les médias, ils étaient très intéressés de connaître toutes les violations qui ont eu lieu pendant le G20, mais jamais on m'a demandé. En fait, on m'a souvent demandé, qu'est-ce que tu penses de la violence? Est-ce que toi, tu as été violente? Ça, on me l'a demandé beaucoup, mais on m'a jamais demandé quelles étaient mes idées, mes motivations pour aller au G20. Ça, ça intéresse pas les médias. Puis évidemment, si je n'aurais pas été arrêtée, ça les aurait pas intéressés non plus. C'est extrêmement difficile dans un sommet comme au G20 où on a une multiplicité de messages. Je pense que c'est beaucoup ça. Pendant le conflit étudiant, c'était un message fort, uni. Évidemment, il y avait toutes sortes d'idées différentes à même le mouvement étudiant. Mais c'est sûr que c'est plus difficile dans le cadre du G20. Mais les médias sociaux ont un pouvoir qu'on ne soupçonne pas.
Hi, Walter Tom from Concordia Student Union Legal Information Clinic. I just have two questions, okay? One regarding the whole issue of law and order, or perhaps law versus order. One of the things which I had noticed, and I date back to the Quebec Summit in 2001, was that, of course, there were always the mass detentions and arrests as well. But one thing which I also noticed was the lack of an effective habeas corpus and the complicity of the courts, in not, you know, providing effective remedies. So I'd like for you perhaps to comment on, you know, what I call the complicity of the courts, of the justice system in that. The second thing is the whole question of accountability. I've worked on many different issues. I've worked with, you know, on different municipal issues, particularly of that of policing. And one thing which I noticed is that, you know, in the police administration, there seems to be a goodwill. I mean, the talk is there, you know? The policies are there. However, every time, okay, there's implementation, there seems to be their, you know, off-the-record feedback is that they can't enforce it on the brotherhood. They can't enforce it on the unions. So it's almost as if, and I'm going to be provocative here, that there is within the police forces a kind of paramilitary movement which the police themselves can't control. Once again, you know, how do we deal with that? Toronto, Montreal, I'm not sure about Vancouver, but we've all seen, you know, how the police unions have been so powerful, even more powerful perhaps than the administrations themselves. Well, I'll leave those as my two points.
I'll just make one really quick comment, which is that, you know, you often hear a lot about the rule of law when in the context of demonstrations and when there's a sort of a loss of order. And the comment I would make about that is that the rule of law applies to the police as well. And what you see and the CCLA, I meant to say this before, the CCLA has done terrific work on G20. Has done huge amount of work on G20, but you know, there have to be better mechanisms for police accountability when the police themselves violate the rule of law, and they do that. In my view, I'm not an expert on this stuff. They do that, in my view, by these mass detentions. And you're right that we don't seem to, for whatever reason, we don't seem to have a system of habeas that allows this to be. It allows for expedited judicial review so that people cannot be, even if it's for only a matter of 60 hours. I mean, 60 hours is a long time. You know, it should not be taken lightly, in my view, that people can be detained without ultimate charge, or even with charges that are trumped up, without a remedy from the courts. And so I think you make a really, really good point. The last thing I would say is I like what you had to say about that period of, what did you call it, cooperative policing?
Cooperative policing,
yeah. Yeah, if there was some way for us to go back to that or build on that, I think that would be a direction to follow in the future.
Just on the whole, when I talk about complicity of the courts and the lack of an effective remedy, the habeas corpus usually is addressed after the particular event is over, of course.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I mean, not well.
And I think one of the issues, from the CCLE's perspective, one of the issue that arises is that even when people are channeled through the courts, as many were, to process the system, people are asked to sign conditions of release. They're not in a position to negotiate these conditions. So I think our concerns has been, and this has not been talked a lot, but that there were many conditions that the police were giving that were, you know, do not come back, do not protest again, do not do this, do not do this. And I think this, and this creeps in under the consent issue, you know, like, well, please sign, you know. And there is a real undermining of the rule of law through that way. There's a lot of conditions, I think, and then even bail conditions that I think were questionable, and it's very hard to get judicial review of these conditions. So this is an area, I think, where the organization is interested in exploring how we can sensitize that you cannot impose, you cannot ask for unconstitutional conditions would be our position. But there's a real issue there as well. So sorry, I just thought I would, add to the complexity of the debate on this.
And maybe I'll just respond to the second question. I think I'm not sure if I would agree if there is. Of course, the police would be different, right? The VPD is extremely different from the Sûreté du Québec, and there's different cultures in all of them. My experience has been predominantly with the British Columbia Police and, to a degree, some others. And whether or not there's a culture, that I'm not entirely sure. I think part of the problem is that we've never had an effective civilian review system. And because the police are – and the police have always, in almost virtually every jurisdiction, fiercely opposed a very – especially chiefs of police in losing their power to discipline their own officers – I think it's created a culture that they know that there's very little accountability. I mean, you see on videotape some brutal abuses of people getting badly beaten, and the police officers have long seen how that there's going to be little punishment from that. I mean, you've even seen in British Columbia, especially the shootings and killings of certain people, and the comments by leaders in the police saying that, well, you know, it's not really your issue, or we'll take care of it, it's not a public issue. Or the recent case of the sexual harassment in Alberta, where they sent them to British Columbia, the officer to BC, which I think says something. So I'm not sure it's entirely that culture is there. And there is no perfect system of civilian review. New York State's got to be an extremely strong one, but even that one hasn't been terribly effective. And it is true that about 80 to 90% of complaints about the police usually only need an apology. So you don't need an independent review system. But the optics are terrible. The optics of when you really do have cases of obvious abuse, when at most you have police officers who are literally, they're demoted to from first constable to second constable for 4 weeks, and they go back up to first constable. You need a system that's got an independent commissioner. You need a system that's in a physical building that's different. You need a system that has non-uniformed police officers doing the investigations. You need also a system that arguably allows a commissioner to override the chief of police in imposing discipline in certain cases. And that's the one that no system in Canada has, and it's very contentious.
And we have a session on that very issue this afternoon.
Oui, bonjour. Considérant le nouveau cadre coopératif dont vous parlez lors des manifestations, est-ce que vous ne pensez pas qu'il y a un risque que ces événements-là soient formalisés jusqu'à un point où elles s'encadrent dans un cours naturel des choses tellement poussé où les autorités que l'on veut toucher, sensibiliser dans ces événements-là ne soient plus concernés, ne sentent plus affectés ou dérangés, parce que ça a été un débat qui a été très présent au printemps dernier, à quel point la manifestation doit déranger? Est-ce que c'est une parade? Est-ce que c'est un événement qui est plus out of norms? Donc, selon vous, où on s'en va avec ça? Est-ce qu'il faut encourager l'encadrement, la coopération, puis jusqu'à quel point? Quel va être l'effet sur la capacité d'expression des manifestants dans ce cadre-là?
Non, c'est une excellente question. Vous êtes absolument correct. On a un nouveau concept sociologique de Social Movement Society, comme on dit en anglais, commencé par les Américaines. Et l'idée avec SMS, c'est que les manifestations, les formes de protestes ont devenu si communs qu'on regarde plus. Et c'est une partie de la vie normale maintenant. Et comme tu dis, le pouvoir d'une manifestation, c'est que c'est quelque chose de différent. C'est quelque chose, c'est un défi à la société, à le système politique. Alors, avec Clay Quatsam, par exemple, l'argument, c'est que c'est devenu si formel, si organisé que c'est pas avec l'effet d'une manifestation, d'un défi social dans un sens comme ça. C'était pas vraiment un mouvement social. Alors, j'ai pas vraiment une réponse à ça. Je suis d'accord avec ce que vous dites. C'est un problème, c'est sûr. Mais en même temps, je dirais que pour avoir une démocratie en bonne santé, simplement participer dans un mouvement social, simplement participer dans une manifestation, c'est bon pour la démocratie. Ce n'est pas nécessairement, comme on dit, que la question, pourquoi ils ne vont pas vous demander, pourquoi tu étais là, des choses comme ça. Même le fait de votre présence, quel l'effet sur toi et l'effet sur moi quand je participe dans un mouvement, ça, c'est une forme de changement social dans ce sens-là. Alors, c'est vrai que peut-être l'objectif d'une manifestation, comme on comprend, changer une loi, changer une pratique, n'ont pas de succès dans ce sens-là, parce que la manifestation, c'est si commun qu'on ne regarde plus. Mais je pense que l'acte de participation, c'est une forme de changer la société. Alors, ça fonctionne dans ce sens-là.
Good morning. My name is Matt Kim. I'm from University of Windsor. I'm a student. My question is for all the panelists. In the examples that you cited of protest movement in Canada, there's often been an international element. They're often in response to or prompted by international phenomenon. With regards to your, Professor, your comments on content neutrality, when we see instances of protests that are connected to, for example, Syria or Egypt, where a protest in Canada would be buttressing fundamental values of Canadian society, such as the rule of law, dignity and worth of the human person, and bearing in mind that I know your comments of content neutrality were with respect to state interference on Section 2 rights, but should we be content neutral when protests would be in support of Canadian values, such as the rule of law, dignity and worth of the human person? Yes.
I guess I would say that content neutrality rules across the board unless there is a compelling justification. I would have said a compelling justification that is evidence-based for interference with the content of a message. And that's sort of, for me, it's a basic principle of the Charter, for Section 2B, it's a conception of expressive freedom that just simply gets applied to public expression. So I'm not sure I'm really responding to your question, but it doesn't really make any difference to me what the content of the activity is, because I take the principle of neutrality very, very seriously, and I would put a very heavy onus on the state whether it's intervening on behalf of certain speakers or certain audiences. I would put a very heavy onus on the state before I would say that any interference is constitutional.